Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. Before we dive right in, Carly?
This is a reminder that our program is unscripted and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And a reminder about all the ways you can support us, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Tell your writing friends about us. We love to help as many writers as possible. And of course, follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more.
Thank you, Carly. Right, Cece, will you kick us off with that first query letter?
Let's do it. Dear Cece, thank you for everything you, Carly, and Bianca do for aspiring writers. This podcast has been not only informational, but inspirational as I seek representation for the first time. Complete at 100,000 words, The Coder and the Fairies is a modern retelling of The Shoemaker and the Elves that balances the wonder of magic against the pedestrian reality of sexism in the tech industry. This novel will appeal to readers of humorous, women-centered urban fantasy, such as Sarah Gailey's Magic for Liars and Alice Hoffman's Practical Magic. When Kylie's chatbot demo to the CTO is co-opted by her co-worker, Eric, it's business as usual on her all-male dev team. But when the demo mysteriously contains a feature she never added, she realizes that someone or something is writing code for her overnight. It's not one of her co-workers, all convinced they are the most elite developers to grace the halls of the company. It's certainly not her boss, who has given her 3 months to earn a promotion before she will be pushed out. It might be her AI chatbot gaining sentience, or it might be the playful help of actual bona fide coding fairies. To flip the magic-infused demo disaster into an opportunity, Kylie strikes a deal with the fairies. Help her win the promotion, and afterwards she will set them free on the internet. For a blissful moment, Kylie is crushing bugs, dominating demos, and, for once, smashing her boss's expectations. But the more she works with the fairies, the more Kylie fears that she might have been relying on them rather than her own skill all along. And the more she hesitates to set the fairies free, the more mischief they stir up. As Eric and her other co-workers grow ever more suspicious of her string of recent successes, and Kylie's mother once again begins to hound her for a loan, Kylie realizes that holding up her end of the fairy bargain will never be an option. Not if she doesn't want to be fired, or worse, disappoint people. I am a software developer based in New York City, and I have worked in the tech industry my entire adult life. This novel draws from my own experiences of sexism and ennui that pervade the tech space. Thank you so much for your time and consideration. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Catherine.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. Can you give us an indication of word count and then your take on that?
So this one came in at 400 words. Before I get into my critique, I would like to ask a question that should be rhetorical at this point if you're a longtime listener. And if you're not, then maybe it'll be new. What is the job of the query letter, right? Like wherever you are right now, listeners, answer this in your head. Like if you're walking your dog, if you are doing the dishes, if you're just sitting down with a notebook, what is the job of a query letter? Answer this for yourselves. The job of a query letter, of course, is to get the agent to want to read the pages, right? Like that is the job. That is the first and foremost job. That is why you write query letters. That is why we read them. And this query letter is doing its job because it's such a cute premise. It's such a cool hook that I want to read the pages. I'm excited to fall in love with a story that seems really interesting and different. So yes, you're doing your job. So to the writer, congratulations. It's doing its job. I'm curious now and I want to read. I will critique this, of course, because that's what we do here, but keep this in mind. So I do wonder, are you saying this is urban fantasy? Because you didn't really say that this was your genre. You said it would appeal to readers of, and I'm just wondering whether that was intentional. It's actually really interesting because as we record this, yesterday, we had an expert on all things sci-fi and fantasy, Dongguan, on our retreat, our deep dive retreat. So it's kind of fun that we're talking about this now too. But yeah, I just felt like your genre wasn't super clear. Again, I really love the hook about like someone writing code for her overnight and then she finds out it's fairies. I did think that the major dramatic question, it did not feel as propulsive as it could. So here's an example of something that would be more propulsive and more plot driven. She's crushing it at work, right? Because of the help with the fairies. And then someone suspects that she's doing something illegal. You know, there's no way you'd be getting all this right. And so the police investigation begins. And the only way she can prove that she is not doing something illegal is to prove that she's actually using the help of the fairies, but she can't do that because it's magic. Now, that would be an external plot point, major dramatic question, right? But right now, the only real pressure is whether or not she wants to do the right thing and set the fairies free. It's too internal, right? Like she needs to decide whether she's going to follow through on her promise or not. But I don't really see consequences one way or another besides her own morality since she's the protagonist. And so I just wanted more external pressure. As a second comment, the fact that her mom begins to once again hound her for a loan, that to me felt like it was coming out of left field. I understand that it's probably a subplot, right? But you really want to aim for that whole dominoes tipping over for like one thing led to another, which led to another. So maybe there's a way to clarify that in the query letter, that causality, because it would make it more compelling. But again, this is all me poking holes and giving you tips on how to make it even better because, like I said, it's doing its job. I'm really curious.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, your thoughts?
All right, I'm going to start at the top. So, okay, word count, title, and the retelling. 100,000 words is longish, but again, when there's world building involved, when there's a lot of story, I'm just going to say, you know, if we were over 100, you know, I would be maybe more curious. The fact that you're like, it's 100,000 right on, I'm like, Are you rounding down or are you rounding up? I'm just a little bit curious about that. But that's okay. We're in the ballpark of SFF, you know, word counts and all of that makes sense to me. The Coder and the Fairies. This is an interesting title to me because I'm thinking about who your target audience is, what your future book cover looks like, and some questions like that. And so when I think about the Coder and the Fairies, I think about, is it going to be a cover where, you know, she's typing at her computer and there's just like fairies in the back? Like, I'm just trying to figure out, like, what does this cover look like in terms of AI sentience and like how this is going to come across? And so, I don't know. I'm curious if this is the best title because Coder also, again, is very like tech forward. And I'm curious about like how tech forward this book is in terms of like technicalities versus the setting. So I'm curious about whether this is the exact right title. And then the modern retelling, right? The Shoemaker and the Elves. And so this title is The Coder and the Fairies. It feels like the title is just trying to mirror the kind of beats of that inspiration. I posted about this on Instagram recently, but whenever I request a full manuscript, I always ask for alternate titles because it gives me a really good insight into how you, the author, imagined your book and how it kind of like comes to life in your mind. And I usually always just find something really interesting. And maybe they're, again, none of them are the right title, but it tells me a lot about how you think about your book. So I would be super curious about this person's other title options and how they kind of frame and think about their own book. I'm worried, again, because it's framing The Shoemaker and the Elves, that, you know, we could be more original potentially and a little bit more curiosity inducing with the title. And now the placement of the modern retelling of The Shoemaker and the Elves. I would put this in the bottom. I would put this with the author bio in the work in the tech industry, da 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 da, explaining, you know, your background and then, you know, how the modern retelling comes to life and how that kind of intersects with your tech background. Because I don't know, I just feel like when we lead with retelling, sometimes that can get really stuck in our mind. And then when it's at the bottom, sometimes it's like a little bit of a surprise. It's like, oh, this is a modern retelling, you know, and that's like, it gives us a little bit of intrigue. By the time I got to the query letter, I kind of forgot it was a modern retelling. So I think you get more bang for your buck if you move it to the bottom. But I think this is really interesting with this, like the sentience. And I think this is a really interesting little mashup here.
My question is, in terms of giving away too much, this author spent quite a bit of time on who is responsible for this. You know, is it the boss? Is it the co-workers, etc.? So I'm assuming that in the story, this character goes through a process of elimination to figure out who it is. So if you put a bam right there in the title, you take away all the intrigue of her trying to figure out who's actually helping her. And you even have to wonder if you're going to put that in the flap copy. It depends at what point in the story it's revealed to be the fairies. But, you know, I know for me, when I'm writing this kind of thing, it's always difficult. Like in my latest book, one of the characters gets killed halfway through. And I really want to make sure that in our flap copy, we don't specify which character gets killed because that gives too much away. So for this author, depending on where in the story the fairy reveals come from, you may also not want to give too much away because then the whole time the character is going, is it this person? Is it that person? The reader's like, man, we already know. So why are we wasting time on this? Okay, Cece, will you tell us what's in those opening pages?
Yes. So Kylie is at her desk waking up at 8 a.m. after pulling what was practically an all-nighter. Her last memory is of being up at 4 a.m. at her desk working. And she looks at her work on her computer and is startled to see that the mistakes on her code were fixed. And though she doesn't have time to fully test it, it seems to be working. And she isn't sure how, because who would have done this? She doesn't remember doing it herself. Could she be sleep coding? Could it be Logan, her colleague who keeps stealing her ideas? Could it be another colleague? Software updates appear on her screen, but then she closes them because now is no time to be updating softwares. Logan appears, but since he doesn't take credit right away, she realizes it wasn't him. And then Eric shows up. It's not him either. Even though she asks him, he's like, what are you talking about? And then on the way to the meeting, Logan, the coworker who keeps stealing her ideas always, takes her laptop and is like, well, I'm doing the presentation. I talked to so-and-so and it just makes sense for me to do it. And she's confused because it was supposed to be her. It was supposed to be her big moment.
Thanks, Cece. So I guess the opening pages does sort of answer that question of how early on it is revealed to be the fairies, but still something to think about. Okay, Cece, do you think those opening pages did the heavy lifting?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when you mentioned the reveal aspect of the fairy collaboration, because the first line is something I highlighted. And I'm going to read it for everyone so we can share our thoughts. It's the first night the fairies fixed Kylie's demo. She thought it must have been Logan. So in my opinion, this is too much too soon. You are leaking the tension by just telling us this, especially since we then go back in time. Not go back in time, but we then like zoom in and she still doesn't know it's the fairies. But you've already told the reader it's the fairies. And so much to Bianca's point, we're spending all this time going, but like, what is the point of her not knowing if we know? At the beginning of every story, and this is something that I teach in my writing tension class, you have three sets of questions. You have the questions that the reader knows, the questions and answers to, but the protagonist doesn't. You have the questions that the protagonist knows the answers to, but the reader doesn't. And then you have the questions that the storyteller knows, right? Like, and these three buckets matter when you're planning tension, when you're planning reveals. And there's clear formulas that you can follow in order to up the tension and really leverage the tension and conflict into stakes. And so here, I think you're leaking it. Like, I don't think it's in your best interest to do that, especially since when the software updates come up, there is all the name of these softwares, and then there's like FAE dot, dot, dot. So that to me was like a hint to the reader, a clue. But like, why did I want the clue? Because I already know what the fairies are responsible, you know? All you're showing me is that she didn't catch the clue, which there is a point to that. There is space for the reader knowing, but the protagonist not knowing. But in my opinion, there needs to be something the reader also doesn't know. And right now we know everything. And again, that just leaks tension. So I would not do that. Obviously, it's totally up to you. I also think that this is not starting in the right place. We have 3.5 pages of her alone, reviewing her code, going through her interiority of what could be happening. Again, these are all answers that we already know, not in detail, but we already know. And it's well written. And I like her interiority, but we don't have curiosity seeds. And so I just don't think it's the most compelling setup. I would start with the presentation. You know, I would start with her being in that presentation room, feeling the pressure, still on the subject of what we expect and what we already know. From the very first page, she asks, could it be Logan, you know, the coworker who's always stealing my stuff? And then Logan kind of grabs the laptop from her and takes over at the end. So I'm not surprised when he does that, because I was told from the very first page that Logan is the kind of person who takes credit for her work. I was infuriated. I was upset at Logan. I wanted to punch him, but I wasn't surprised. And so this actually brings me to my second point, which is it's really important to have surprise in the first 5 pages and subvert the reader's expectations and have that moment of, oh my gosh, I didn't see this coming. That's really, really important to keep us turning the pages. Surprise is the thing that more than any other element really makes us crave more plot. And yeah, I just think that it's not... like these two things are fixable if it matches with your vision. I kept highlighting a whole bunch of other things that I think you can work on. Things like, for example, when she wakes up at 8 a.m. and there's no one there, is this typical? Are people usually there? Was she thinking like, oh my God, like I have to go brush my teeth? Or is she not that kind of person? Like I just kept wanting more interiority from her. But I really like the premise. I want you to know that. I really like the premise. I think it's such a fun idea. I love books about women in male-dominated spaces. I think that there's so much potential there for depth and commentary and just fun. And so I'm really curious to know what you're going to do with this story. I just think that right now it's a little slower than I would want.
Thank you, Cece. Carly?
All right. One really small thing, and then I want to talk big picture as well. So you talk about the pandemic at one point. I would just strike that through unless there's some sort of theme that I didn't see coming, or, you know, this literally wasn't mentioned in the query letter is something that's going to be on topic for this book. I would strike that out. Okay. So now I want to talk about, so Cece just said like things are maybe moving a little bit slow in some regards. And I feel like we jump right into action, which I give the author a lot of credit for, because I really want to know what happens in this meeting, right? It's like, she was like up all night working. Like we're really, really thrown into the mix here. We've gone right into the meeting. I think there is some stuff that needs to be sharpened a little bit more to make sure we're not feeling like the reader is skipping things by going right to the drama. So I think I agree with all of Cece's points, but I want to give this author a lot of credit because I do really like that we jumped right into a major situation. But yeah, I agree with Cece said.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, we are now going to our second query letter. Will you read that for us, please, Carly?
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, we truly appreciate the knowledge we have gained from your show and would love the opportunity to receive personalized feedback. Due to her interest in young adult fiction, this queer letter is directed towards Carly Waters. We read on your manuscript wishlist that you are currently seeking young adult. We are contacting you as a potential fit to champion our 59,000 word YA urban fantasy novel, The Fair Kind. Fans of Sarah J. Maas's The Court of Thorns and Roses and Kelsey Kicklighter's of Beasts and Burden will enjoy our debut novel about a teenage girl who risks everything to pursue her first love with a human. With her nonsensical name and lowly teenage status, 17-year-old Jane is apprehensive about attending her new school. And Duplicity, the horrid girl who just so happens to be top of their class, is quick to humiliate Jane when she doesn't present any magical abilities. Jane begins to wonder if her less than extraordinary existence might be better suited somewhere else, somewhere like the human realm. Far away from the magical forest she comes from, Jane bravely crosses the mysterious land of man, desperate to find acceptance. A kind rancher takes her in and puts her to work in his stables, offering her a chance at normal human life. But the wild urges she gets around his devastatingly attractive son threatens to upend her newfound contentment, not to mention her life if he figures out who she really is. This book was co-authored by two lifelong best friends from Florida. The Fair Kind is complete with plans for an additional 3 books to follow. We have pasted the first 5 pages below and we'll send the full manuscript upon your request. Thank you very much for your consideration. Warm regards, Nicole Kutzer and Holly Randolph.
Thank you, Carly. I don't think we've featured a lot of Books with Hooks queries where we have co-authors, so this is really interesting. Okay, what was your take on that?
All right, so it clocked in at 298 words, which is pretty short for a book that revolves around some world building. So that was really interesting to me. I was like, oh, either they've done a super punchy job getting everything, or we might be missing a few things. So that's where we clocked in. One thing I want to say is that this made me think, when's the last time my manuscript wish list was updated? Because manuscript wish list is a third-party website. And so they rely on agents to go in and update their materials. I looked at the picture that's on manuscript wishlists. It's of me from at least 10 years ago. So it's not super fresh. And so I need to go update my manuscript wishlist. So I don't work on a ton of YA these days, unless it's from an existing client who's, you know, writing across categories. But again, that was just a jog of memory to me to be like, I got to go update that. And a reminder to you guys that that is a third-party website, right? So they are either taking submissions from agents or aggregating it from across the internet. So you do not know how factual or accurate that information is. So always go to an agent's actual agency website or their personal website for their most up-to-date information. Okay, so the comps here, I mean, coming to Sarah J. Maas is pretty tough. I mean, you know, she is considered the best in the business in this category. So, you know, it's a bold comp, but you know, if it's the right comp, then it's the right comp. And you're the one that is obviously best to decide if it's the right fit for you. So, I mean, all in all, I do find a lot of this kind of just vague and generalizing and also, like, again, missing the world building that makes SFF so unique. So, you know, the line about like who risks everything, right? So I'm like, well, what is everything? You know, her family, her land, her power, like what everything? What is everything, right? Everything means different to different people, especially in world building, because I don't know anything about her world. So I don't know what everything means to her. So that was a bit tough for me. I'm also really curious about about some of the positioning stuff, right? So it's 79,000 words, which is short for YA. And this revolves around world building. So I'm like, okay, this is interesting to me. And then we get into the whole, like, her first love with a human. So I'm like, oh, first love, like, oh, it's so cute. And, you know, I don't know how this is going to be handled in terms of a spice level even. Like, I don't know. But then the next paragraph is kind of very much like middle school-ish for me, because it's about the horrid girl who happens to be top of the class humiliating her, which is a magical build. That sounds a little bit PG to me. So I'm like, I don't know. I'm just very curious about how much each of these elements kind of comes into play, because the simplistic nature of the class bullying felt a bit middle grade to me. But then I'm like, the romance element seems more, you know, YA or even new adult, right? Like, I don't know, you know, how in depth this kind of romance blossoms into, right? And I can't know that because I don't have all the pages. So I definitely just need to know more about the world, I think, to understand this more, because you know, in my notes I had, I think you can do more to explain why she might be more special in the human world and show that contrast. I think that's pretty important, right? And how does she know that there's a human world? You know, like there's just so many questions I have about, you know, this world and how she can even like cross into the other world. Is it just a one-way ticket, right? Or is it a two-way ticket? There's just a lot that I'm just, you know, still not sure about in terms of how she decides she needs to switch realms, essentially. I think we need to communicate, like, what is the big thing, essentially, that kicks her out of this realm. I think just this, like, her existence might be better suited somewhere else. It's like, well, that might be, you know, for lunch, I'm just choosing another lunch spot because that might be better suited to my taste today versus like, I'm going to change the entire course of my human existence. She's not human, but like her life existence by choosing an entirely new realm. That's a pretty big deal, right? And so the decision making that goes into that, it just seems a little bit flippant to me. Again, in this query letter, not that it is in the pages, but again, we're trying to communicate all of this through this query letter, but you have some room, right? Because it's a little bit on the short side. So, you know, why couldn't she go back if times got tough? You know, does she have a family? Did she set a time limit for herself? Like, oh, I want to find myself in X number of days or else I have to go back. Or there's a reason she has to go back. And we learn in the pages a little bit about her mom. So I'm curious, it's like, oh, maybe she wants to get back in time. I don't know, something about her mom or family, right? Like, I think we need to set some time limits on this. That would help with that ticking time tensions situation. So those are kind of my high level notes here. Cece, how about you?
So I agree. I just felt like we needed more plot. What is the major dramatic question? Is it intentionally internal? Because right now it is framed as internal, meaning will she confess to him or not? Like how exactly is her life in danger if he figures out who she is? And could he reasonably figure out? Like, does she have to do something that in order to do that thing, she needs to show her powers? And so is it a choice between not doing the thing, not showing her powers, trusting him? Like, I just needed more specificity, more plot. And I empathize very much. And I know we all do because it's hard to know like how much to reveal. But, you know, you in general, you want to avoid lines like lose everything, like Carly said, because it doesn't tell us anything.
Thank you. There's a question that I'm going to want to ask because I know our listeners who care about this, their ears will have perked up, Carly, when you said new adult. Backwards and forwards on this. Is this actually a genre? Is this not a genre these days?
Excellent question. You know, I am not the wizard of the business. Sometimes I really wish I was the wizard of the business where I can just like, you know, make things happen how I want to happen. I still hear people talking about it. I still don't think that it is a category as big as YA or adult. And I do think publishers, given the hook or the circumstances or the book or the plot or something, you know, there's always going to be a time where we're going to see a deal for a new adult novel and then everybody's going to be like, hey, new adult's back, you know? So I think it's just one of those things that's very like a subgenre of a subgenre still at this point. And the industry never has figured out what to do with it. But all this to say, by the time this airs, maybe there'll be the newest new adult and then we'll be talking about it all over again. So yeah.
Clear as mud. Like so much in publishing, right? Okay, Collie, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so we meet our main character. Her mother is quite ill. There is a big knock at the door. There's a storm. We get the sense that the mother is kind of like, you know, probably close to dying, kind of passing away. Like that's how serious her illness is. They live in a tree and there's a big storm. It's kind of like blowing a little bit in the storm. Elders show up at the door wanting to speak to the mother and kind of presumably get her healed. The daughter's trying to like fend them off, just say like she doesn't want to hear from you, doesn't want help. We get the sense that the mother used to be an elder of some kind and kind of knows them. There is some sort of like mind melding that happens. One of the elders has some sort of like mind connection, mind control with the daughter at one point. But essentially, you know, they all leave. And yeah, the mother is ill and they were kind of able to keep the elders away.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, what did you think of the opening? Do you think we're starting in the right place? Is it doing what it needs to do?
Oh, all very good questions. So we start actually with a little bit of dialogue, which I think that's probably not working. The mother kind of has this like croaking, scraping voice and her eyes are really closed and says, you know, he'll be here any minute, the others too. I don't know. I didn't know if like that was exactly the right place to start. We also had two mentions on the first page about storm, which was interesting to me. I think, you know, word choice is just so important, right? So just duplicating any word on the first page is just, I think we should just vary our language a little bit. I think why I didn't like starting with dialogue was because we're not learning anything about the world.
And we're starting with character, which again, isn't the worst. So I'm like, I don't have a definitive answer for you about like whether this is the right place. But, you know, there's a line, as I said, you know, the house is built in a tree. It says, our house is built into the sturdy branches of an old oak. Like, I just feel like there'd be so many ways where we could just like build that into the very opening lines and build the tension of the situation. It's like, there's a storm and they live in a tree and her mother's dying and these people are coming for that. Like, I didn't really feel that eeriness and foreboding and just like drama the way that I really wanted to. So I think there's just a lot of instances where we can think about this from the reader's perspective as much as possible and what they would be expecting or wanting from a story like this. And I really think atmosphere is really what they would be looking for here. And I just don't think we like nailed it exactly on this very opening page. There was a use of italics, and I'm very anti-italics because I always feel like the words should speak for themselves. And italics is just kind of a way to wink, wink, nod, nod at us when I think that the words should stand for themselves. So we kind of move into the world building as we start to learn about the elders. And this is tricky because like there's an example of, you know, Artifice, the elder of tempting, bracket, one of the five offerings, capital O, granted to our kind, bracket. That felt very like nonfiction to me. It was like, oh, here's a person, here's their offering. Do you know what I'm trying to say? And so I don't know if there would be a way that we could just smooth that out a little bit. And we have to meet a lot of people. That was one thing that I was kind of like, oh, we have to meet a lot of people, you know, the elders, and we have to learn all of their skills. And I was like, do we really need all the elders to show up? I always wonder about that in opening pages. I'm like, is every single being in this scene absolutely necessary to introduce us to this book and these characters in this world? Because I get really distracted when there's just so many people to keep straight. And I think what happens is we lose time with our main character, right? Because this daughter is supposed to be our main character. I don't really get a lot of interiority from her about how she, like every once in a while it'll pop in, which is good, but like I don't really get a sense of how she feels about her mother dying. We kind of get a little bit of a sense of at some points how she feels like threatened by these elders. So they don't feel like caring, sweet elders. They feel like very threatening elders, and she feels very uncomfortable by them. But I don't really get a sense of like how she feels about her mother and her mother's potential passing. So I don't know, that piece to me in terms of the emotion of the story was a little bit missing for me. But I've made some notes about like when I thought interiority was really good, you know, like she tries to like bolster her voice and she says, what do I owe the pleasure of such esteemed guests on this dreadful night? I asked, trying to keep my voice from shaking. I loved that, right? Because that's a perfect example of what Cece and I talk about when it's like the dialogue's doing one thing and the interiority's doing something else. So I know that these authors could do it. Like that's a great example of something I think that worked really well. And there were some curiosity seeds, like Artifice says, curative needs to heal her before it's too late. But I'm like, what is too late? Do they mean like dying too late? Or do they mean like too late for their world? Like, I don't know. That was a little bit of a curiosity kind of inducing thing there. But yeah, I don't know. I think number one, SFF is not my, you know, my jam. So I always feel a little bit, you know, conflicted when giving advice, obviously, because it's not something that I work with all the time. But storytelling is storytelling. So I hope my advice is useful.
So thank you, Carly, for that analysis. I agree with everything you said. To build on it, towards the very end of the pages, after the elders have left and she's talking to her mom, she says, they just want to help you. Why won't you let them? I blubber in confusion. And then her mom says, don't be foolish. And then she yells at her mom, you never tell me anything. I'm not a child anymore. I understand her not expressing these emotions in front of the elders, because of course she wouldn't, right? She's keeping her feelings to herself. And that is interesting. But we didn't see it in her interiority or her emotionality either. We didn't see her going, could my mom possibly be convinced by this new argument this person presented? Or I wish I could tell them that I agree with them, but I can't. Like, we didn't see her withhold. And we have to, because we should have access to her interiority and her emotionality because we're in her head. So once again, in the dialogue, it makes sense for her to be withholding, but not inside her psyche. We need access to that. And that would actually make the whole scene with the elders way more compelling, in my opinion, because the question I kept asking, and you know, Substack subscribers will be able to see my notes, but I kept asking things like, but how does she feel? Like, I get that her voice was shaking. And so we did have bodily cues to know that it was something in the realm of fear, but I didn't understand how deep it ran or what specifically it was about. And I really wanted to, because that's how we connect with character. The trick to writing emotion and writing tension is to map out power imbalance. You know, in a scene, you have to have, you have two different people or however many different people, you have to have power imbalance running. And then you have to have the protagonist withholding something. something. It could be a tiny, tiny thing. It could be a major thing. And because of that power imbalance, that withholding matters. And so you have the setup here because there is clearly a power imbalance between her and the elders. And she clearly is withholding because we learn when she talks to her mom that she's like, "Mom, come on, you should have done this." You really just didn't show us that. So I feel like I really wanted to have that added, and that would be my note for you. Like, just go back and weave in that interiority and emotionality because it's really interesting.
Thank you, Cece. My suggestion to the author in terms of managing that many characters up front is maybe have that the elders send an emissary or an ambassador or two. So it's just sort of one or two people who come on behalf of all the elders. And these are particularly powerful or nasty or sinister or whatever it is vibe that you're going for, which means that you then don't have to, give that sort of info dumpy in brackets where they're from and what they're in charge of. Perhaps one of them even introduces the other one because they knew, and that gives an organic opportunity to say where they're from and what they're responsible for. So that might be a way to cut down on that in the opening pages. Right, Carly and Cece, thank you so much as always. Now let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a 1-month language course. Think about the cost of 1-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Today's guest is a San Antonio-based author whose short stories have appeared in several publications since 2006, including Pseudopod, Strange Horizons, and the No Sleep podcast. His fascination with frightening fiction started when his kindergarten teacher played a record of the classic ghost story, The Golden Arm, for her class. The Spite Out is his debut novel through Tor Nightfire. It's my pleasure to welcome Johnny Compton. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's wonderful having you here. And reading that intro, I can't help but wonder if children today are going to have the same kind of stories played for them in school, or if it's like, nope, that's not going to happen.
It seems very unlikely. I'm fond of saying that anytime I'm not fond of saying it, but I frequently say it anytime I relay that story, that I don't think that would fly in the current environment.
Yeah, which means you wouldn't be the writer you are today. So that's pretty damn sad. Something for parents to think about as their children's reading material gets censored and curated in these kinds of ways, right? So before we begin chatting about the book, Johnny, could you just read the flap copy for us for The Spite House so our listeners know what the book's about?
Absolutely. Eric Ross is on the run from a mysterious past with his two daughters in tow. When he comes across a strange ad for the Masson House in Degner, Texas, Eric thinks they may have finally caught a lucky break. The most haunted place in Texas needs a caretaker. All they need to do is stay in the house and keep a detailed record of everything that happens there, provided the house's horrors don't drive them all mad, like the caretakers before them. The job calls to Eric not just because there's a huge potential payout, but because he needs access to the secrets of the Spite House. If it is indeed haunted, maybe it will help him understand the uncanny power that clings to his family, driving them from town to town, too afraid to stop running.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so that didn't give you guys goosebumps. I don't know what will. So, Johnny, I'd never heard of a Spite House until this title. And then I looked it up and then you explained it in the book as well. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that?
Absolutely. A Spite House, as the name suggests, is a house built because someone wants to spite someone else. They're feeling ill-used, they have a disagreement, they're angry, and they want to in some way convey that anger in the best way they figure to do it, or the circumstances surrounding it lead them to build a house in order to show not just the person that they're angry with or the entity, whether it's an individual, whether it's the government, whether it's an organization, what have you. The best way they figure to do it is to build this house and sometimes maybe even live in said house. It's a very fascinating topic. I'm glad I was able to introduce it to you, as it appears I've been able to introduce it to many others. And I always encourage people, if nothing else, go look up all the stories you can about spite houses. It's really amazing that people have actually chosen to display their anger in this kind of fashion time and again throughout history.
Yeah, something that immediately resonated with me is that I know that in South Africa, I was aware of a beach house that was quite far back, and these people were not very well liked within the community, and didn't realize that the pocket of land in front of them did not belong to the government. And somebody bought it up and built a shell of a property, sort of three stories high, just to block these people's view. So it's, you know, it says a lot about how far we will go as human beings to spite other people, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just shows how petty we can be sometimes,
right?
In terms of how angry you are. Just think of I just want to block your view, which is oftentimes the case with a lot of these spite houses, or I just want to have this be something that is so close to you that you always are going to feel how angry I am. Last year at StokerCon, I talked a little bit about spite houses, and somebody stopped me and said they think their grandfather lived across the street from a spite house because he had bought a house. And I guess it was a bidding war or there was something along those lines. And so the person who he not took the house from, but who he outbid, they built an exact replica of that house across the street, which I guess probably nowadays doesn't sound that dramatic, depending on if you live in certain suburbs with kind of cookie cutter homes. But this is from a time when having a house that looked exactly like yours in the same neighborhood was more of an oddity. And apparently they just built a house that was an exact replica right across the street just to remind him, I wanted that house. And now I've got one just like it. It's odd.
Wow. It's like going to the party, to a party, and you think you're wearing a really stunning dress and someone else is in the exact same dress, except this is a dress you can't take off. It's around all the time, man. So that's interesting. And what you said about pettiness as well was interesting, because I don't know if you watched the show Beef.
Yes.
And that is such a perfect example of how small, petty things can become something huge, and how these characters' sort of degree of pettiness and anger and the beef they have with each other has such far-reaching consequences. And the reason I discuss all of this is because horror is such a fascinating genre in terms of what it explores about the human psyche, about the darkness within us. And you operate a podcast called Healthy Fears, which covers how our fears are explored through horror fiction. And I'd really love to unpack some of that and listen to the psychology behind writing and reading horror fiction.
Wow. Great breach in the topic. I'm so glad that you brought up Healthy Fears, even though it's a terribly neglected podcast. I am very proud of the episodes of it that I have up there because it reflects my interest in horror in a lot of different ways, just in terms of how fear is approached as always being a kind of a, not always, but typically a negative thing when it is discussed. And in contrast to that, my approach to it is a little bit of, well, fear can also save your life. The healthy, reasonable, rational fears of certain things, a fear of, if you're, going back to probably our deepest ancestors, a fear of a certain animal, a fear of a sound in the night, is an alarm, and it's an alert, and it's going to make you aware that maybe danger is present, steer clear. And so approaching it that way, psychologically, I try to get into the mindset for myself and then for my characters. What are you, not just what are you afraid of, but does it make sense for you to be afraid of this? If it does, is that still going to be able to help you? You can be afraid of something, it makes sense to be afraid of it. And like I said, it could save your life. But there's also a case where you're cornered by whatever the threat is, and your fear is not really of much significance or use to you, at least. It's obviously significant to you, but it's not going to be useful. So you try to unpack those moments for the characters. And otherwise, is the fear more irrational? Is it going to be a hindrance to you? And try to balance those things out. What is going to be, the exact nature of their, what it is that's terrifying them? And then try to take it, from myself, put it onto the page, and then from the page, hopefully transfer it over to the reader. And all of these, kind of high-minded, ambitious concepts, as I say, all those things, they definitely factor in. But then also at the end of the day, I grew up, as you mentioned, I fell in love with horror stories at a very young age. And I've always wanted to also just scare people. It's kind of fun in a, reasonable, obviously not do anything harmful to people sense. But yeah, the first time somebody told me that my book gave them a nightmare was a milestone for me. So I was like, oh, I've really made it now. That's awesome.
I love that. I'm scaring the shit out of people. Woohoo! Yeah, one of the manifestations of fear as well, is debilitating fear. And I think that something can be used to great effect in horror when somebody is so overcome with fear that they actually cannot act, that it, completely debilitates and they freeze up. And, the thing that I find very interesting about horror is the interplay between tension between the reader and what's happening in the story. Because a lot of books can be very passively consumed. You're just lying there, you've got a cocktail in your hand on the beach and you're kind of passively consuming it and you're enjoying the story. But I think horror, more than any other genre, makes its readers do a lot of heavy lifting. They've got to kind of imprint their own fears on what's happening in the story. They've got to theorize what's happening and, they've got to be scared on behalf of the character.
Yeah, we are asking a lot of the reader there. I always kind of think of it in terms of the somewhat disadvantage of horror is that something that would be scary in real life just by default isn't necessarily scary on the page or on the screen or what have you. So if you were on the beach with your cocktail and you're reading a book and then a walking skeleton came out of the water and approached the beach, everybody would be horrified. Because that's kind of cliche now, though, the idea of the phantom skeleton, I think in my head now, I just added the element of it coming out of the water, which I think adds something odd to it. But my point, I think, that still stands of it's kind of seen almost as a mundane feature of horror now. So you have to then try to figure out something that, whether it's in your language, whether it's in the setting, something in the presentation, something in the moment, whether it's the way you've hopefully had the reader connect with the characters on a deeper level so that regardless of how they feel about the literal object of fear, the subject itself, the character, the fact that they're afraid makes you afraid on their behalf regardless. You have to do something in order to try to draw them in because, as you mentioned, we are asking quite a bit of our readers and of our audience. We want them to feel this similar emotion and be on the ride. And then at the same time, you're balancing out the fact that fear is incredibly subjective. And so even if someone's not, there are tons of horror stories as a huge horror fan still. there are tons of horror stories that I read, watch, what have you, that don't necessarily scare me anymore because I'm so seasoned in the genre now. And, you know, I can kind of observe when something's going to happen, etc. But I'm still just drawn in and I care about the characters. And so I'm not necessarily scared, but I am invested on their behalf. I still really want them to make it, or I want them to make the right decision, or I'm curious about what decision they're going to make and what path it's going to lead them down. And so you're balancing all of these things simultaneously of, I really want to scare people. If I can't accomplish that, because again, it's entirely subjective and kind of out of your hands at a certain point, can I at least get them invested? And so you're always trying to juggle all of those different features simultaneously, which I know is to some degree what anybody in any genre has to do to a certain extent. But as you mentioned, horror, fear, that, you know, the idea, the concept of fear and the reluctance people have to even engage with it sincerely a lot of the time, where there's, I think, a fear of a certain vulnerability of actually showing and acknowledging that you're afraid of anything, causes people to be resistant to the idea of even, like I said, engaging with it with any level of sincerity. And so you're combating all of these different things in horror that maybe don't show up the same way in certain other genres, where people more freely engage or more casually engage without having to feel as vulnerable as maybe the fear would make them feel.
Yeah, I mean, something else is that never mind making the reader feel scared when the character's scared. There's times when the characters aren't scared and I'm like, man, you should be scared. You know, and that happens in horror movies as well. It's like, why haven't you run? Why are you just, you know, walking around with whatever in your bikini, la, 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 because someone's clearly coming for you. I'm scared for you. Please run. So there's that as well. And something as well is, you know, you talk about certain elements that have now become mundane. But there's certainly moments where the mundane can be super creepy depending on how you write it. Something that somebody wouldn't look at twice normally, if there's just one tiny little thing off about it, then it can become super creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, something as simple as, you know, a house and certain features of it, this thing that we all seek, and it's shelter, it's a fundamental of life that we all are pursuing and all we, you know, want, not just a house, but a dream house, etc. And then the slightest thing could turn it against you and turn it into something menacing. I just got off of a panel that I did about The Haunting of Hill House, one of my favorite books. And there's the famous opening paragraph for that book. But to open the second chapter, Shirley Jackson also describes the features of a house and how they can look like a face sometimes. And it only takes a slight piece of it being askew, the dimensions feeling a little off, for it to turn from something welcoming to something seemingly threatening or at least off-putting and make you concerned. And so, as you mentioned, the idea of the mundane then kind of being turned on its head a little bit. I enjoy all varieties of horror, or I shouldn't say literally all. There's probably certain things that are not for me, just as it is for anybody else. But I have a pretty wide range, and the Spite House is just one brand of it. But it allowed me to explore this idea of something as slight as, why did this door seemingly open on its own? Which is a pretty cliche thing, but then what can I add to it that makes it a little bit more frightening and menacing in the moment? It's not just that the door creaked open on its own. What other features, what other actions take place in the house and in this moment that are going to ramp up the horror? And I'm talking around it because I don't want to necessarily spoil that moment for anybody, but it's one of the things I was really happy about when I wrote it, a particular scene involving a door and what's happening with it, because it gives you that opportunity to take something that is familiar and give it your own twist and hopefully enhance the fear that it's capable of giving people.
Yeah, that brings me to my next question, which is about world building, a sort of supernatural or paranormal world. So for you, when you write, does that come up front to inform the plot? You go, these are the constraints of the world. These are the things that can happen in this house. This is how far this paranormal, whatever activity can go. Or does it evolve as you move the plot forward, get to a certain point and go, okay, I need something to happen with the door, but it can't be the normal thing. So now I need to come up with something different. For you, what comes first, or do they just inform each other?
A certain amount of structure for me comes first. I'm not hugely into confining for the supernatural elements of it. I don't necessarily create absolutely strict rules per se, but there needs to be some sense of stability and expectation. And then you can work on defying those expectations. Part of the fun of writing within the world of the supernatural, paranormal, I mean, even real life, oftentimes. There are things that we are going to expect to happen, and there's a routine, and there's a sort of predictability. And then being able to write something that flips that on its head, or even just tilts it to the side a little bit, can just be so thrilling and fun, and I hopefully is going to also entice and enthrall the reader. And so for me, I start with the structure of what is happening. You know, when I wrote The Spite House, I knew who was haunting the house, the nature of Eric, his aforementioned secret and his family, what's happening with that. And then, as you mentioned, as I'm writing it, certain things evolved in terms of what is going to enhance the story and make it hopefully even more intriguing and interesting. And then certain things I also pull back and I say, even if this is the rule and this remains the rule, I might not necessarily make it overt on the page, make it as overt as I initially intended on the page. And so I want people to be able to either infer it, or I want them to question it. And I want it to remain mysterious and leave them with some sense of wonder about what one thing might mean or what another thing might mean. For me personally, I'm also a big fan of keeping things in the supernatural realm. Not necessarily, I don't want to say the word vague, but the mystery of the quote unquote unexplained is kind of how it was presented to me when I grew up. Even I remember there being books that I would be attracted to in the library, and frequently they would use the word the unexplained as kind of this catch-all for anything paranormal, anything metaphysical, not commonly accepted by science. And so I'm still drawn to that idea of what if we just don't have an explanation for everything, because inherently it's supernatural. It's something that either doesn't exist or is not commonly understood, one way or the other, whatever your beliefs are. And so we can't have an explanation anyway. One explanation is just going to encourage additional questions. So we might as well embrace the inexplicable element of it.
Yeah. And again, that's where you want your readers to do the heavy lifting, right? They can come up with their own theories as to how this works. And this is how fan theories happen. And people hop onto forums and like, this was my take on it. No, this was my take on it. Because people love to try and figure it out. It becomes a puzzle. And that leads to my next question. We chat a lot, Johnny, about planting curiosity seeds that you water throughout the books that later they can grow. And it's little bits just to make the reader go, ooh, that's interesting. Let me start coming up with a theory as to what I think is happening. And you do that so well here. So we have Eric at the beginning of the book. We know that he's kind of running from something. And as his POV unfolds and as his daughter's POV unfolds, we get that, you know, they are in hiding. And you start to have theories like, was he in trouble with the law? Did he snatch the children from a wife? Like, is he a bad person? Because we're forced to kind of question what kind of a person he is based on his fathering and based on the fact that they are on the run. And you don't give us that easy answer. So we do sit and kind of grapple with that. So when it comes to horror and balancing out the curiosity seeds and the tension, do you use like a template, like, for example, Save the Cat writes a novel that has got various action beats that says by halfway through act one, this should have happened. This is then what should happen to raise the stakes. How do you keep raising the stakes the whole time? Or do you have like a different process that you come to maybe more instinctively through the fact that this is a genre you've always loved?
Wow. Terrific question. So I don't have a definitive template. I do try to... In my mind, I keep the approach of not having my entire story hinge on a particular reveal. And so for Eric and his daughters, and they're on the run, like you said, there's a mystery behind it. I knew what the twist was going to be. I also, in terms of, like you said, structure, plot beats, where certain things should happen, I knew that around the range of when I wanted to reveal it was going to actually precede the climax by enough that this is not going to really feel, hopefully, like this is what the entire story is really building up to. This just becomes an important component of the story, because a lot of the time, especially if you're dealing with seasoned readers who are familiar with mystery, horror, anything of approaching that, they are going to suss out even your wildest twist if you're being honest about the twist. And if you're being a little bit of a cheat about the twist and coming from complete left field with it, where there's zero possibility that they could have guessed anything, you're not leaving any kind of breadcrumbs at all, people tend to feel a little bit insulted, maybe, or treated unfairly, for lack of a better term, I think by the story itself that they're so invested in, hopefully, and trying to engage with. And so I keep these things, I kept those things in mind when it came to The Spied House and my second book that I've finished up and that'll be coming out next year as well. Things that I'm revealing, again, as it comes along, I try to not have any particular revelation be the entirety of what the story is building up to. I try to structure it that way. I also try to keep in mind as far as what I'm withholding from the reader, writing it in a way, because you have multiple POVs, writing it in a way where if the characters are not speaking about it openly, there's a reason for it. It doesn't just feel like they're being coy for no reason other than I'm hiding my secret as an author. And so I'm forcing my characters to talk around it in a way that maybe feels unnatural. And so with The Spied House, hopefully, what I tried to accomplish was with Eric's secret, when he's talking to Des and Stacy, and nobody's really letting on to it, it is in part because it's so painful for everybody, and hopefully I convey that, that nobody wants to speak on it openly. Those who are aware of what is actually taking place, they don't want to discuss it so frankly because it's too painful to even bring up. And there are hints earlier in the book that certain word choices are picked up on and kind of shrug it off because it hurts too much as a reminder to even say that. And I felt like that hopefully gave the characters a reasonable level of discussion where when you finally get to the revelations, it doesn't feel like, well, they should have said this. This should have come up much sooner. And for whatever reason, it didn't. And the reason actually just being the author didn't really have a good way of protecting the secret that they wrote. And so they made the characters behave in ways that didn't really make sense or speak in ways that didn't really make sense in order to protect that secret above what would work better for the story.
Yeah, plausibility is so important. So if you're going to make that choice, it needs to be plausible and go, oh, okay, they haven't spoken about it because this is trauma. These people are processing trauma and this isn't a family who talks about trauma. So that makes sense. I hate that kind of cheat reveal where there was no way you could have figured it out. Like when there's, you know, right at the end, there's this character who comes in who we've never heard of. And I'm just like, where the hell did this person come in? And it upsets me. So for our listeners, I've done two really good interviews. One was Mark Tavani, who's an editor at Putnam, who does a lot of thrillers. And he was talking about how you need to be hiding things in plain sight all the time. And if there's a reader who's really astute, they maybe can't figure it out just then what it is, but they file it in the back of their minds so that later when you get the reveal, they're like, oh man, I knew that. That was hiding in plain sight. And another interview to listen to is when I interviewed Jeffrey Archer. He said the best thing you can do is when you give the readers something in plain sight, follow it immediately by something so shocking that they forget the thing that you gave them in plain sight, because then they focus on the shocking thing. And it's only when they come back to it that they will see that they had the information all along. We don't have much time left, Johnny. I had a whole bunch of questions, two that I'm really going to try and get to. One is your social commentary. I really loved the social commentary that was woven throughout this. This is a horror story, but this is a Black family as well. And there's a lot of commentary on what it is to be a Black person and a Black child in spaces that are predominantly white, how people perceive you, etc. So can you speak a bit about your reasoning for wanting to do that, make the social commentary in the book, and how our listeners might do the same so that it's woven into the story? It's there, but it doesn't feel like anybody's, you know, having a finger sort of waved in the air in their faces.
Great question. It was important to me, and I felt like organic to the story and to my experience, obviously, as a Black person, that you feel some of these things. So early on in the book, even they're in a place unfamiliar to them, and they're in a diner, and Des, the oldest daughter, notices we are the only people of color that I can identify immediately in this diner. And she comes from a place where that is unfamiliar to her. She normally would not feel so isolated. And this enhances the fact that she's already aware of we're on the run. We have to be extra cautious. And so these kind of things, I feel like the way I was able to weave them into the story, I love that, you know, the way you put it, woven into the story, it's not what the story is entirely focused on, but it is an important component at various intervals within the story. And I'm able to incorporate it into the plot. And if you can do that, I think that's I'm always wary of giving anybody advice because your story is your story. And so write it to the best of your ability, whatever it is that you think is going to be effective for you. Having said that, I try not to stop completely the quote-unquote action. And by action, I don't necessarily mean literal action, fight scene, chase scene, haunting, what have you. The action of somebody just thinking about their circumstance. It's a quiet moment. It's quiet action, but I still think of that as action. And so when they're thinking of things, I don't want them to stop dead in their tracks to just contemplate, I'm black and I'm here and this is, you know, the entirety of what I'm focusing on right now. But if it can be incorporated into something like, we're on the run and I'm paranoid about that enough as it is, and now I'm surrounded by people that are, feel more unfamiliar and they might be thinking of me in a certain way and focusing on me in a certain way because I stand out here more so than I would back home. These kind of things I felt were important to incorporate into the story. And so, like you said, it's woven in. I'm hopeful that it's woven in a way that feels organic. And I do think that I would encourage people, again, write your story as you see fit. If your story is about somebody who is a literal preacher and they do need to kind of drop the anvil, so to speak, on someone's head about this is what this is about, that might be fitting for your story. But if it doesn't actually work, don't force it. Just have it flow into it naturally. You're going to have plenty of opportunity for that to happen if you're really thinking ahead about your story.
Yeah, excellent answer. And last question, mm-hmm. is writing a child like Stacy in the third person close POV, that must have been a hell of a challenge because you got her super close to her. It almost read like first person. And I often say third person close gets really closer than first person. So can you speak a bit, what was her age again?
She's six or seven. It's kind of a vague, deliberately vague kind of thing.
Yeah, round about then. So your advice to people who are writing characters of this age, because it must have been really challenging, and yet you pulled it off perfectly.
Thank you. It was challenging. Easily the most challenging parts of the book. I'm not a father of, you know, young children anymore by any stretch. I've had some young children in my life, but you didn't have, you know, you got nieces, nephews, what have you. I didn't have anybody immediately to draw off of, you know, I didn't have like kids running around where I could think, oh, I could pick your brain about how would you feel about this situation or anything like that. I tried to simplify without dumbing down is, I guess, the best way I could think to put it. I wanted her to feel, or in those chapters, I wanted to convey the sense of being overwhelmed from that childlike perspective, but I didn't want it to feel like I'm speaking down about her, speaking down to the audience from that perspective. Simplify things, focus on what's going to be most important, and yet at the same time, approach it as she's a reasonably smart little girl, reasonably smart, but not overly precocious, not so intelligent it suddenly takes you out of the story and you start wondering, is this some kind of child genius beyond anything that anybody could, you know, reasonably relate to? Again, just simplify without dumbing down, I think, is the best way I can try to describe that. And I don't have any plans to try to do anything like that again. I've at least got experience with it this time, so now I know I could do it. But for my debut novel to actually do that, I realized this at certain points when I was writing it, I was like, this is a bigger challenge than I needed to put on my plate. But this is the story I wanted to tell, so now I've got to figure out the best way to do it.
Yeah, no, you did it incredibly well. It is funny how debut authors start doing something because they don't realize how damn difficult it is. And they're like, okay, I'm in it now, so let me do it. But once you know better, you're like, I don't know that I would have done that again. Yeah, so for our listeners, we are linking The Spy's House on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy it there, you support an independent bookstore, you support the podcast, and you support Johnny. Johnny, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. is for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.